Ray Bureau on April 12th, 1977. Can you tell me where and when and how long you studied with Tabby Toe?
Where was in Philadelphia. And the most intense part of my studying was his last 3 years in the orchestra, which was from 1951 to 54. And this was during a period I was in the Marine Band, and I used to come up on weekends and take lessons, private lessons, and sometimes we had a woodwind ensemble that we brought up from various service bands in Washington. And after that, I saw him at least 5 summers, usually in Nice, where he had retired. And that's where the recording project initiated.
What was Tabby Toe like in lessons? Did you get along with him?
Mean. No, he had a strange sense of humor, and if you took him seriously sometimes, you could really get yourself in trouble by getting uptight. And I was in an enviable position because I was not in Curtis. Not that I dislike Curtis, but being a professional oboist at the time, he treated me a little bit better than most of his Curtis people. And by treating badly, I mean his musical standards were so high that, and it seemed like a matter of life and death if you did anything wrong that could tie up most people in knots as far as their music was concerned.
Was Tabby Toe particularly didactic? I mean, was there only one way to look at things, or I mean, how open was he to different interpretations?
He wasn't very open with other people's interpretation. His way was usually the only one, and he had thought it out very well and could explain why he thought it was the only one. He could explain it, but like the rest of his teaching, as a famous oboist once said, who had studied with him back in the early days, that we learned in self-defense. He would keep kicking you in the right direction until you supplied your own right answer. And that's why most of his pupils, in answering any question concerning the oboe or music, will come up with different answers, but they will come up with the answer that worked for them.
Did he explain his concepts clearly?
As far as drawing you a perfect picture of what he was after, no, he did not. I mean, for instance, as scientific as I can ever remember his getting concerning vibrato, was that it comes with the wind, and you figure out where the wind comes from.
So lessons didn't follow in any logical progression.
Well, logical, we all had to go through the Barrett book. In fact, he could spend 4 years on the Barrett book, if you would like. And you had to almost force him to start listening to solo repertoire, or especially orchestral repertoire. And of course, I was interested mostly in getting his interpretation of the orchestral repertoire.
What would you say are Tabby Toe's most important ideas?
To put it in one word, I would say flexibility. And what fascinated me most about him was his sense of a variety of intensity and a variety of tone color. He put it in words that most people would not understand. The people who did not study with him that have heard the tape, I think, usually don't know what he's talking about on the down-up impulses. You can hear or make up your own concept of his playing. But he was using very mediocre equipment, and sometimes what he was doing very beautifully really did not come through in those tapes.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain the down-up impulse?
Well, I could explain it better with an instrument, but I'll try. This is my own self-defense, is what, and it kept me out of trouble with him after a couple of years. But the down impulse corresponded with a harmonic resolution. The up impulses were everything between resolutions, and the more up impulses you had in a row, the more intense the sound became until it resolved again, and you would start all over in the next phrase. For Tabby Toe, no note was standing still. It was going away from something or towards something. And for me, the intensity or motion in the sound is composed of three different things. The most obvious is the vibrato, or lack of it. The various speeds of vibrato are none at all in the beginning of a phrase sometimes. The second part would be, for the oboist anyway, the speed of the wind through any given size opening. And the third part, less obvious, that we have to be very discreet about, is the pitch. As the intensity increased, we usually get sharper, as most good string players can tell you. And the vibrato gets faster as it becomes more intense, and we blow a faster stream of air through the opening.
You said no note is ever standing still. On a down impulse, would that not be a note that's standing still?
It would be relaxing.
But it's not standing still.
No. And the beginning of the down impulse was the most intense part. And of course you could have more than one down impulses in a row, but usually one note took care of the resolution and you relaxed very quickly before you started all over again. I'm not saying that he would not play a note without vibrato. If he was playing with a clarinet player, he could very easily turn it off, of course. You asked Colico my relation with Tabito, and besides being just a student for 3 years, I was later in the Philadelphia Orchestra, and after that time is when I spent time in the summers with him. And I think out of respect of, I can't say colleague, because he was no longer in the orchestra, but for some out of respect for somebody playing in the Philadelphia Orchestra, he gave me much more than he would have an ordinary student that came over. And also by that time he had gone to Nice, and the Frenchman over there didn't know him from any other Frenchman. They didn't know how famous he was and what he had done for the, especially the oboe playing business. And he was treated like a bum over there sometimes. So he was very happy to see anyone that showed up who had great respect for him. Because for 39 years, people bowed down to him as the first oboist of the Philadelphia Orchestra.
You've definitely talked about this, but how do you produce up and down impulses? Is what you were talking about to the vibrato and the I guess we covered that already.
Well, as Tabito says, it comes with the wind, and various people interrupt the wind in different ways, and mine comes from diaphragm. And I know a lot of good oboists who use a throat vibrato. I cannot do it, so I don't attempt to teach it even. But the intensity mostly came from the diaphragm in my case. And of course the tone color changes was the different positions of the throat and embouchure.
Now, did he differentiate clearly between up and down impulses and his number system, which the scale of expression, which are the colors?
He did not differentiate very clearly. In fact, he had about three different sets of numbers that kind of rotated. And I still get confused when I listen to those tapes about which set of numbers he's using. One set of numbers corresponded with just the dynamics, and another set might correspond with intensity.
How about embouchure replacement in terms of the colors? Do you adjust? He talks about, you know, moving the reed in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And how did he do this? Or how does it work exactly?
Well, he did it. He literally moved his embouchure in and out. He always was talking about avoiding the crocodile bite, and that meant to have a flexible embouchure so that if you wanted to play dark, you could surround the reed very much, and if you wanted to drown out the trumpet section, you could put very little lip on the reed and play straight out.
But this is something I want to clear up. Is it the placement of the reed? Is the placement of the lips on the reed in a different place, or is it always in the same place, but it's more or less lip?
That's a good question. I think he stuck more or less in relation to his bottom lip to one place. although I've seen him, if he was kind of kidding around and he wanted something to sound raucous, he could stick it all the way in his mouth. But ordinarily, it stayed just about the same place on his bottom lip.
I see. So that really clarifies something for me, because I was trying to, you know, figure out how he would change the placement of his lips on the reed to get different colors, but really was the way he either rolled or didn't roll his lips. On the What about the dolce tone? What does that mean?
I never heard that one before the tapes came out, but he was always making fun if you overblowed. And his quotation on the tape was, what is it? A singing tone? It was an amplification of a dolce sound. I better run the tapes back again. But he was trying to get the sound to stay centered and still project it. He used to make fun of me because at the time I was playing in the Marine Band, I would get louder by just overblowing. And he would say that at one point, after a certain point, that sound is going nowhere.
This is, in my opinion, the quality that carries is the amplification of the dolce tone.
Very good, yeah.
The dolce tone is the nearest to zero.
Well, zero was where we were supposed to know about every reed. It was where nothing happens, and the difference between zero and one is the crucial. That's not what you asked.
Fine. What about articulation? Were there principles of articulation also?
Well, he made a lot of fun of people that tried to differentiate articulations between a slap tongue or a... some people have a system where they use a da syllable or a ta syllable. I won't mention any names, but that's what he was going off on a limb about, on the no ta, no ti, no da. Mm. He tried to get away from articulation as much as possible. Even when he played a staccato note, he didn't want to hear the beginning and the end of the note. And I can't remember his ever describing how to do that. And I've tried very hard for my own students to tell them not to hit too much reed or to get their tongue on the corner of the reed, to avoid an ut on the end of it. Slurs. He made quite a big deal out of slurs. He used to play games with us of playing one note and you were supposed to guess what the next note was. He would try to fill in the intervals on the one note. And if he did it right, you could just about guess where he was heading.
I wanted to get back to one point. Did he really only have then about the articulation? He didn't vary lengths of notes, or is that something different? I know in some phrases where you have a repeated note, you want to make the first note short and the next note a little bit longer and the next note longer to show kind of a motion forward or... getting longer, and that would be just, but that would be within his definition of articulation, or was it always the same? There are two things, ta and ti, and there wasn't any variation in between, or were there variations?
There were quite a few variations in between. He described it as scaling the notes, and scaling the notes meant starting, as you said, short ordinarily and going longer as it approached the climax or the important part of the phrase.
Could you explain a little bit more about the end of this how that would be done?
The end of it?
End of a slur. It says if two notes are slurred, only the second one is actually affected. Space between the notes slurred is taken away as the sound is continuous.
Well, he made a big deal out of of that. One of the outstanding examples that I first got hit over the head was Barrett number one. And if you chopped off the second note, or even if you didn't chop it off, you still got a lesson on the da da di long, da da di ya da. That second note of the slur, or as he said, the only note that is slurred, has nothing to do with the staccato note that follows it. And to get through the lesson without getting your head chopped open, you would play ta-ta-ti-ya-ta. The end of that note went exactly up to the beginning of the staccato note that followed it.
That would be long, as he would describe, that would be long.
Yeah, ta-ta-ti-long, yeah.
Okay. So I understand something. Okay. Can you explain this thing on the breathing about getting rid of all the air?
Well, and as usual, he would exaggerate an idea like that that was became so ridiculous that you couldn't forget it for the rest of your life. He actually did not play on zero air like he was describing, but he was trying to get away from, you know, players that play the oboe by completely filling up, mm-hmm. and you become a balloon with nothing to do with the air. I mean, there's no control over it.
Uh-huh.
And he felt that if you were playing on very little air, you had to support it from the right place. It had to move. That ah business would represent his getting rid of all the air, and then you would play a long phrase after that.
Did he actually teach breathing? I mean, did he teach you to set the breath or anything like that, or where the air should be taken in?
As far as describing it in words, not at all. But as I was saying a while ago, he would come up with such a ridiculous idea that you couldn't forget it. For instance, he caught me one time leaning back in the chair when I was supposed to be supporting. And he said, "No, you cannot play that way. If you ever got between my toes of my shoes and the floor during a concert, I would crush you to death." And after that, I started putting my weight on my toes, and I found that it worked, and I watched him in the orchestra, and his weight was so on his toes when he was sitting in the chair that he would actually get up out of the chair sometimes.
Do you think that Tabito always played by his principles of distribution of inflection and skill of expression? Do you think he worked out everything that he played in terms of numbers and up and down impulses?
I've heard him spend literally hours on going over one phrase, and he used to throw things at us like you'd do a phrase that wasn't very well thought out, and he'd say, "Okay, next week you do it 10 different ways." And as far as actually thinking him out, he did it in his own studio. But as the tape said, those numbers were for lesser days. It means days when you really don't feel like you're playing, you want to play a concert, but you've got to play the concert. And that's what the numbers were. It was a standard that he set below which he would not go, reed permitting, of course.
Could you, using a selection of your choice, describe how up and down impulses and groupings would be used?
I can think of two examples. Both Brahms were quite descriptive of what Tabito had in mind on the up and down impulses. The down being where the harmonic structure resolved, the up was becoming more intense, leading into the next down where it resolved all over again. Now, the first example that I have in mind is Brahms' first oboe solo, starting on the G. And the grouping on this would start out in three-note groups. On the that would be up, up, down, up, up, down, and then five ups in a row. And that top D would not be the top of the phrase intensity-wise. You would go into the following A flat intensity-wise, but you would get softer at the same time before it resolved back into the bottom of it and you got out of the way of the clarinet player. The other example I can think of you had asked, what does the intensity or ups and downs have to do with the dynamics?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a good example of that would be in the Brahms Violin Concerto. It's the last time around on the top of that is marked 40, and the bottom of it, you're supposed to be getting softer, but much more intense as you go down that last time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a good example, I think, of the ups and ups and ups getting more intense while you're getting softer. But as Tabito used to say, that you should get on the end of that deafening pianissimo, which he could blow the whole orchestra right off the stage and play pianissimo.
Well, we're talking about the violin concerto. What about the bar line? How would you phrase Well, the first part, the opening solo. Would you phrase on the bar line, or?
No, we try to ignore bar lines, and very often I think people mistake you're playing by bar lines, because the logical place to resolve a chord or to make a down impulse would be on the first beat of the bar line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the mistake that a lot of people have made is by phrasing before you get to where you're going,
mm-hmm.
before the resolution. And that was one thing that Tabito always emphasized, was going to wherever it resolved, and usually that just happened to be the first beat, but not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
The strong beats were the logical places for something to resolve, and the beginning of the resolution would be the most intense part of
uh-huh.
It's misconceiving at first. You start talking about up and up and up and then a down. The students don't understand at first that the beginning of the down is where they're going, and then they relax.
Uh-huh. Could you say how you would do let's say the first three measures of that solo of the Brahms violin concerto in terms of down and up impulses?
Well, I'd start the A on a down, but without really resolving it on the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then three ups in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And that the top A that I just arrived at, the fifth note, mm-hmm. would be a very gentle down, because you've got somewhere to go after that.
Yes.
There is where you're going, the mm-hmm. G, and then you can relax.
Mm-hmm. What about the C?
The third note?
It's...
There?
Yeah, the last note of the measure.
You mean on the beginning?
No, the last note of the second measure. Da-dum, that one.
I don't have the music here.
Okay, it's the last note of the second measure. It's dee-da-da-da, dee-da-da-dee-dum. It's the low note.
Oh, yeah. I try to round that off into a very gentle down and almost connect it with the next A, but it is detached
uh-huh.
gently.
Uh-huh. Does that C does lead into the A then, slightly?
Yes, I think it does. You have not relaxed completely until you get to the A.
Mm-hmm. Okay, shall we talk about syncopations and dotted notes, if there were any special techniques about playing dotted notes?
He wanted you to go to the middle of the syncopated note and then relax. And his friend Moise points out the French word for syncopation is something like succomb, which means to drop dead or stop breathing or your heart stops beating. And Tabito always pointed out that your heart stops beating in the middle of the beat after it has gotten to be quite intense.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would be like an up-down, and the down would be in the middle of the syncopated note.
Mm-hmm. Was there... in a dotted rhythm, like the opening of the Eroica slow movement solo, dun, da, dun, is there a little space between the long note and the short of the dotted note and the 16th note?
Yes, that's about a 2-hour space when you're playing. Well, the dot, I always feel like you're weightless going over that dot. Dun, da, dun. You round it off, but it's still going up.
Mm-hmm.
Up, 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 down, very gentle down. But, that's another example of that first note of almost decrescendoing, but still becoming more and more intense, because the third note of the third G is where you're going. And since it is a very intense funeral march, those first three notes are the crucial point of getting it off the ground.
How about in Beethoven's seventh? You know, it goes dum ba dum bum ba dum bum ba dum. How is that done? Is that the same thing where you go into the dot, but there's maybe a little space between them?
I think the dot definitely. And it would be up, up, down, da, da, dum, up, up, down, da, da, dum, da, da, dum, da, da, dum. You would be going to the dotted eighth note every time. That's the rhythm you're talking about.
Yes, right. Hard to tell.
But very definitely, the beginning of the group would be on the 16th note, and it would be going to the next main beat of the dotted eighth, and there would be a punctuation on the dot.
Okay. Did you ever hear Tabito say it is important to remember to place one's notes on the bow or the wind and not to bow or wind the notes? Can you explain that?
Well, he was trying to get away from people that started a note by blowing into it and coming out with something bulb-shaped and consequently no line to the phrase. And he would place his phrases on a series of numbers, which was heading in one definite direction and then back down again. By winding a note would, I think, mean a crescendo and then a decrescendo on the note,
mm-hmm.
which we do sometimes on purpose, but not usually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How important was rubato to Tabito's playing?
Very, very important. He, as Bloom used to say, performed fancy robbery. He would get by with whatever he could get by with and still have the discipline of coming out on the main places with the conductor involved. But by fancy robbery, he meant you took away from one thing and you gave it to another.
Mm-hmm.
When the reed was working right, he played quite rubato-ish. That also depended on the conductor and the reed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he had a high average as anyone in the business, mostly because he worked 6 or 8 hours a day.
On reed? Let's see. Did he talk about reed making at all?
Sometimes he would try to avoid it, and I was one of the lucky ones that took my oboe lessons in his reed room.
Mm-hmm.
And when my lesson was over, well, he would start making his own reeds. And I could peek over his shoulder and, as he used to say, steal his secrets. And I don't think he was that scientific at to really have a lot of secrets to steal, except making from 5 to 10 reeds a day. And, but he had a very high concept of what that reed should allow, and he would tear up reeds, and a lot of other people would gladly play concerts. So I could watch to see what he did. Sometimes he would get mad at a reed and do something really wild to it, just to experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think the back cutting of the reed started. He probably got mad at a reed and made a slice out of the back and suddenly discovered that it had more depth.
Mm-hmm.
So he would try it again.
Okay. Let's see. How influential was Tabito, do you think?
You mean in the general musical scene?
On oboists, on the woodwind world, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Well, I'll take it one at a time. Oboist, I think he set the standard of what we are supposed to live up to nowadays. And I think his pupils, they are the predominant players in this country. And of course, his pupils are turning out bigger and better pupils now, which gives us all something to think about. But I think even the pupils that are being turned out now are still being taught by concepts of Tabito's pupils that they didn't necessarily understand at the time. Some of us have had 20 years to think about them, and it just dawned on us what he was talking about. What was the two others?
The woodwind playing.
Well, woodwind playing, I think he brought the oboe up to the level of instruments that are supposed to be consistent, like the flute and clarinet.
Mm-hmm.
Before Tabito's teaching and his playing, I think that we were forgiven for having a bad
Well, he must have influenced a lot of prominent players who are now prominent players through his chamber music classes at Curtis, probably.
Oh, yeah. You'll find all kind of woodwind players putting his name on their teacher list.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like our great clarinet player in Boston, Buddy Riot, is one of my favorite woodwind players in the world. And he says Tabito is his teacher, which he certainly was.
And what about the Philadelphia Orchestra? How much do you think he influenced the way they phrased?
Well, I think he had more to do with it than anyone else, except maybe Stokowski.
Mm-hmm.
I think the combination of Tabito and Stokowski is what built this whole concept of oboe playing. Stokowski would pick out one thing that he liked and encourage it, and of course Tabito would go spend 6 hours before the next rehearsal, and it would be even better. But the Philadelphia Orchestra, when I was there at least, and I'd say 75% of the people had been through Curtis and had been exposed to Tabito. And consequently, they could come out talking about a phrase with the same concept, same numbers, the same up and down impulses. And that's one reason that that orchestra was consistently high standard.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Were there any of Tabito's ideas that you didn't like or rejected or whatever?
Well, you mean musically?
Yeah, musically.
I can't think of anything right now.
Okay.
He would occasionally come up with something that I thought was right at the time and talk me out of it.
Uh-huh.
But I can't remember now what I thought was right that he talked me out of.
Uh-huh. Okay. How original do you think these ideas were with Tabito, the ups and downs and the numbers and that sort of thing?
That's always interesting me of where it came from. I think very much of it came from his imitating the best string players in the business.
Uh-huh.
He was always very envious of the great concert artist who could pick up their $100,000 Strad and it would be exactly like they left it yesterday and they didn't have to make a new read for the day. And he would try to imitate their vibrato and their intensity,
mm-hmm.
and everything that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And he would always compare our embouchure with being close to the bridge or close to the fingerboard,
mm-hmm.
and our breathing with the speed or pressure of the bow. It was always from a string player's point of view, or imitation, I should say.
Did he ever mention his teacher, Gillet?
Yes, he kind of worshipped him. As far as giving any direct ideas of Gillet, I can't remember his giving any musical ideas.
I see. Okay. Let's see. I should pick up on a few things that I skipped over, if that's all right. You didn't talk about the playing of intervals, which is really basic technique, but did he have any special ways of teaching the playing of intervals?
Well, he would pick out an interval, starting out on basic, one, say a fifth. And if you play first the scale of connecting all five notes, and then maybe play the chord, a major chord, up to the fifth, and then play the fifth, and the fifth was supposed to come out exactly where the scale was when it was beautifully connected.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole object was to get the low note, in most cases, to go to the high in intensity and dynamic without there being any space in between at all.
Mm-hmm.
He compared it on the tapes to the horse jumping over the hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
When he got to the top note, he was already on top of the hurdle. And he had done his work,
mm-hmm.
and the next note took care of itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did Tabito talk in terms of character, phrases, or moods ever?
Not specifically. He would give you examples of what you're supposed to be describing. I guess that's specific enough.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was supposed to be dancing, well, he'd go dancing around the room.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe play it for you or have you dance while you did it or be sad. As far as doing anything definite, like saying, well, this has got to be a darker tone color, like we some of us try to do nowadays, but it's going to be darker because it's sad or it's minor.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get that specific.
Yeah.
You were supposed to figure it out yourself.
Okay. I can assume that most of these things that you've talked about, you teach your students or pass on to your students as well. Is that true?
That's right.
Okay. Is there anything that we missed that you think we should talk about?
You have mentioned here, how did he teach on numbers? I can't find the specific, the scale of numbers. He had at least two specific scales.
Mm-hmm.
One was an obvious dynamics, and he would have you start on most lessons of playing a five-note scale, and one was always as soft as you can get, next to zero, which is nothing, and five was as loud as you could get,
mm-hmm.
and then back down to one again. That was the beginning of the lesson, usually, and then one to five to nine to five to one, each note being exactly where it should be if you're using a ruler, a micrometer to measure. And then about a year or two later, after you were getting the numbers, he would add to that the down and up impulses superimposed on the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You ask also about vibrato. How does it fit into this? I think it's a very important, obvious part of the motion or intensity, although it's not the complete thing at all, but the vibrato you hear either stopping or speeding up or slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
Although Tabito did not teach vibrato specifically. In fact, he deliberately avoided it. Should I just go down the outline?
Yeah, why don't you go down the outline, see if there's anything that...
You ask about groupings. He took an example of... each group was like a joint of a finger. And finally, you had the whole finger, and then the next, you had the wrist and the elbow, and the complete arm was the whole phrase. And the groupings was anywhere from two notes to whatever that joint of the finger included, and
mm-hmm.
probably up to five or seven.
Mm-hmm.
Bar lines he ignored whenever he could. Are slurs and groupings related? Most of the time, I should think so. Are slurring and groupings related? Well, most of the time, a slur is part of a group.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke of one thing that always confused me, of being able to get rid of the air while playing, and the only way I can figure out how to do that is to blow it out through your nose, which a lot of his famous students do.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard him do an occasion, but you can get carried away with the idea and wind up being heard in the third balcony if you get rid of the air. I never understood exactly how to do that without making a racket doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Did Tabito have a special breathing technique? It was to use less air and more support, and he really insisted on breathing regularly, which most oboists don't do.
Mm-hmm.
We usually go until we run out of air and do something stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I think that covers.
Yeah, I think so too. That's great. Thank you very much.